Hello and welcome to the New Zealand Initiative podcast. I'm Dr. Eric Crampton, Chief Economist with the Initiative, and today we're talking about council debt, infrastructure funding and financing, and whether councils really are as debt constrained as we might think in being able to deliver appropriate infrastructure. Seems to be one of the big bottlenecks in some areas, like electricity. Lines just show up when a new subdivision gets built. Nobody much worries about it. The lines companies have ways of funding and financing their kit, and it just works. In water and other council-provided services, not so much. It takes a long time, it's seen as a burden on the rest of the community, and it seems to be one of the impediments to both the prior Labour government's urban growth agenda, and it could be, well, for the incoming government's differently named urban growth agenda. The Infrastructure Commission has been doing some work looking at local government debt. Great new report came out 2 weeks ago now, I believe. It's called, Is Local Government Debt Constrained? We have with us today the report's author, Graham Campbell. We have Peter Nuns, and we have the initiative's own Nick Clark, who has been looking through this as well, both with his initiative hat on and his local government business forum hat on. So welcome, everybody.
Thanks for having me.
Great. So first off, Peter, maybe tell us a little bit about how Infrastructure Commission came to do this work, and then tell us a bit more about Graham and getting him in on it.
Yeah, thanks, Eric. The context, the one you say, right, that pricing, funding, and financing works well in some areas and less well in some other areas, and we get different infrastructure outcomes as a result. That was something that we highlighted as one of the big sort of strategic drivers of different outcomes in different areas in the infrastructure strategy we published in 2022. At the time, however, we knew that there were a lot of different aspects of this, different sort of technical ins and outs that we didn't fully understand that we needed to inform ourselves about and, you know, inform others where we found something interesting. One of those areas was local government debt, right? And so I was really pleased to get Graham on board last year and get him looking under the hood on this based on some of his previous experience at sort of the state legislative analyst offices in the U.S., looking at, you know, how some of this plays out in a different institutional context. So we put him on to this topic in New Zealand. I'll get Graham to maybe speak to what he found.
Just briefly, State Debt Management Office, that'd be crazy fun on this, because if I'm remembering right, U.S. municipal debt is something on the order of 62% revenue bonds rather than general obligation. And the SPVs that you're talking about in here are a lot more like the revenue bond structures that they have in the U.S.
It's certainly very, very close. Yeah, it was a good experience to dive into the New Zealand context and provide sort of a different lens on the issue. And so taking a look at local government, we see here that, you know, local government is a major player in infrastructure networks. And so how they debt finance infrastructure here was one of the goals of the paper, and to overview the various tools that they use.
Sure. So bottom line, are councils debt constrained? Is this the real constraint?
Well, I think it's a nuanced question. I think Peter has described this as a Rorschach test. I think overall what I would say is that the question of whether councils are debt constrained is one, how do you look at the various tools, right? So what we think is that overall there's probably flexibility in the system. There's three tools that local governments use to finance debt. They use the LGFA, they issue debt directly to banks and in international markets, and then you use SPVs. Whether you think those tools are debt constraining depends on what you think the price of debt should be, right? And so there's one view that says that, well, because most councils are borrowing from LGFA and there's a debt limit under LGFA, that once they hit that limit, they are debt constrained. There's another view that might say, well, there is other things like SPVs, which are sort of a release valve that councils, when they are at their LGFA debt limits, can utilize SPVs and have it not affect their financial situation to fund infrastructure. Or they could.
Now, I'm just going to pause you here very briefly. SPV, what do you mean by that for those who haven't heard the acronym before?
Yeah, SPVs are a relatively new financing tool, debt financing tool for infrastructure in New Zealand. It stands for Special Purpose Vehicle. And basically what it is it's a way of debt financing infrastructure that allows councils or even private developers to use sort of a separate entity to take on debt finance and then build infrastructure. So the key feature of these SPVs is that the debt that the councils or private developers take on sits off of their balance sheets. And so they're able to do, you know, to make infrastructure investments without necessarily affecting their financial situations.
It's ring-fenced and it's tied to a revenue stream. And one thing that I'd say actually on this, while when we talk about SPVs, we often talk about SPVs that are set up under a specific bit of legislation, the Infrastructure Funding and Financing Act of 2020. When we spoke to LGFA, the local government funding agency, which basically kind of acts as a kind of centralized borrowing facility for all councils, what they told us was that actually it was possible to set up, self-supporting CCOs or other SPVs within sort of BAU processes without appealing to the IFF Act, right? And that's one of the forms of flexibility that we picked up within the paper.
Now, that seems really underused, and councils have seemed to believe that doing this sort of thing is kind of futile, where the special purpose vehicle would, by the ratings agencies, be seen as subject to bailout by council if something went wrong. Therefore, it'll be under the same kind of ratings, and they didn't want to be punished by the ratings agencies for taking that on. Had I missed something here?
So I think one of the sort of beauties of the SPV is that there's not necessarily a legal obligation for the council to take on the SPV debt, right?
Yeah, agree.
It is entirely separate. That doesn't mean, as we note in the paper, that they are not necessarily, they're not completely separate from councils. Councils may incur sort of a reputational risk or to guarantee some of this debt. The payers of SPV debt are the exact same as council debt as a whole. So I don't know if you've missed a whole lot, but it is.
I guess it's more whether, if I've understood the paper correctly, councils would not be in breach of anything with LGFA if they set these entities up, but they would face a lower credit rating potentially if the ratings agencies thought they were likely to bail out these entities. And since the ratings agencies here, unlike the ones in the U.S., are really not familiar with these kinds of structures, there's risk that they would lump them all in together. One of the neat things that I saw in your paper was the pointing out of, well, actually, if they reduce the council's rating by a little bit because of this, the overall costs aren't that high.
Yeah, and that was one of the things, the revelations for us, right? And this is a quite technical area, and I think it's easy to sort of wander into it and get confused. We learned through the process of this, clarified a lot of things for us. There are multiple ways to measure council debt that different entities measure for different purposes. The LGFA, just to spell out the technical detail, the LGFA is interested in measuring debt at the parent council level, right? So if you're Auckland Council, for instance, they're measuring your debt. They're excluding debt and revenue associated with Watercare, which is considered to be a self-supporting entity, right? And so you as Auckland Council can go and borrow more money, pass it on to Watercare. As long as Watercare's got a plan to repay that out of water charges, that does not prevent Auckland Council for participating in LGFA, right? But the credit rating agencies look at council debt at the group level. Mm-hmm. They will add together Auckland Council and its CCOs and any kind of other things that are deemed to be kind of part of the council group, right? And so when they assess council's credit rating, I should say S&P does it this way, Fitch does it differently, interestingly. But when they assess credit ratings for councils, they will look at the group, right? And so that's actually the kind of interesting thing, is that you've got ways under LGFA's rules to get around the sort of hard debt caps that they set. It's just that they bring you into this world of having to work out whether a credit rating downgrade is worth it for you.
So just on that, on the LGFA side of things, what are their debt to revenue limits, and how do they potentially constrain councils from borrowing to invest in infrastructure?
Yeah, so the way the LGFA works is essentially, you can imagine it's like a club, right? It's a club that councils band together, and they're able to, you know, go out to the market and issue debt collectively. And the benefit to that is it allows them to access cheaper finance domestically and internationally. It also reduces the administration costs for councils. So that's why the LGFA is a real benefit to councils. In order to be a member of LGFA to access this finance, you have to adhere to not just one, but I think four financial sort of fiscal rules that are called covenants, the most important of which is a net debt to revenue ratio of below 280% if you're a council with a credit rating generally, and then 175% if you're a council without or a credit rating below A. And so as councils have taken on more debt to finance infrastructure, particularly the larger and the growth councils, they're starting to approach the 280% limit. So that's sort of what prompted the paper to be written, and the sort of title is there a real debt constraint here?
Sorry, go ahead, Nick.
Oh, I was just going to ask, are there councils that are butting up against those limits? And the guess, if there are, what's the consequence of that in terms of how much debt they can then take on additionally?
Yeah, so there's two, I guess there. I'd frame this in two ways. Are there councils right now that are close to the LGFA debt limit? Right now, most councils are not right up against the LGFA debt limit. There's about three that are over 200%. But when you look in the future, based upon council long-term plans, what you see is that councils, the growth ones, we're talking Hamilton, Tauranga, Auckland, Wellington, they're approaching that 280%, but they're not going through it. And so that sort of hints that they're holding back infrastructure investment or taking on more debt to stay under that limit.
And the reason this is a problem, right? So that 280% limit, what that means is that for every additional dollar of revenue you've earned from a new source or an existing source that you've dialed up a charge on, you can support $2.80 of debt. And that's not a problem for everything, but it is a problem for sort of certain types of infrastructure, particularly sort of infrastructure that's long-lived, has a long payback period, where you might be counting on, if you're counting on a revenue stream that might accrue over 20 years to repay that infrastructure, it's going to be very difficult to finance it at a ratio of $2.8 dollars of debt per dollar of revenue, even if you've got a good revenue stream.
I think that I'd started writing on that circa 2015, and I think that it was because Chris Parker had been yelling about it for rather some time to anybody who'd listen, and he was dead right about it. Something struck me when you were talking about the potential downgrade in the debt limit that you face with LGFA. So if I've got that right, if a council sets up a separate CCO as an SPV to be able to take on debt that has actual revenue, the financial cost of a debt downgrade from ratings agencies that see these as being tied together isn't just the small incremental increase in financing costs. It might be that you have to refinance all of your debt because you're now in massive breach of your LGFA covenants because you went from being at 200%, which is fine relative to 280, to 200%, which is not fine relative to 175.
Well, no, I think the point there is that if you restructure yourself in that way, and you carve off some revenue generating activities into a CCO or an SPV or something, LGFA is actually kind of fine. They'll sort of say you can stay in the club.
But if you do that and become more highly leveraged within that CCO, and you're assessed at a group level, and your rating then goes below A because of it,
LGFA doesn't kick you out.
Okay, I had misunderstood what you'd said earlier then.
Sorry, yeah. So what Peter is saying is that, there are different paths for councils who want to, get around the debt limit. One way is to create a CCO that generates its own revenue.
No, I understand that part. What I hadn't understood was when you said that councils that are not rated or have a credit rating below A have a debt limit of, 175?
Yes.
If a current council, by restructuring and then leveraging a CCO, became BBB+, as consequence, when rated at a group level by S&P, would that then mean LGFA treats them as having a different debt limit?
Yeah, it would lower. Yeah.
Okay, so the incremental cost of doing this isn't just the slight increase in financing costs. It is that your whole debt structure becomes a mess because you're suddenly in breach of your covenants.
I think in theory that's correct. I think in practice we're a little bit far from that point because most councils are rated at the AA level. Okay. Some are rated at AA+. And so there's not very many councils that have a credit rating of A or below. And so what it would take for that to happen would be the credit rating agencies downgrading, I don't know exactly what the notches are, but it's at least three notches down in order to get to that point.
But I'm imagining cases where a council might very well want its water company to be far more highly leveraged than normal council debt, and that would wind up, if it were rated on its own basis, it would not be getting a AA+.
right.
How that then affects the overall group if it's rated at a group level. Anyways, I'm getting too far into the weeds, but one thing that I had wanted previously as a potential solution to this was just legislation authorizing councils to issue debt that has a boiling and oil provision. So if they ever bailed out the CCO that was issuing it, like you take the council officials and you literally boil them in oil. Okay, maybe you don't do that. You do something equivalently bad to the council so that everybody understands council would never do this because they would believe that they would feel like they're being boiled in oil.
You're definitely talking me out of going back to work for local government.
The point of it is that you never do it, right?
Well, I wouldn't go back to work for local government. not if that provision's in there. Where we got to in the paper, and this is a kind of another one of those interesting and nuanced points, right? Is what sort of debt structure is appropriate for you, right? And what ratio of debt to current revenues is appropriate is a function of what you're actually building and what you need to invest in, right? And I think that before we work forward to kind of like let's you know look at different paths for sort of loosening up sort of constraints, we kind of have to ask, what are we actually spending the money on?
Yes.
And the thing that we sort of highlighted in the paper, right? And Graham did this interesting thing in the back of it and looked back in a lot of historical data back sort of 120 years on council debt and investment. And what we picked up there was that this time's different, right? And it's different in this interesting and subtle way, which is that we're in this period of sort of sustained relatively high levels of investment by local government and central government as well, interestingly. But at the local government level, debt's rising and revenue is not. And so that's why you're seeing debt ratios rise. That was not the case when local governments did their past investment programs. And we think that the reason for that is basically that you've got at this point a much greater mix of renewal investment. And renewal's got a couple it's good. So we never want to...
Now explain what you mean by renewals here. Does that just mean like maintenance on the existing works and upkeep? Or is it like replacing stuff that's now finished end of life?
A bit of the former, more of the latter, right? So you've got some water pipes in the ground. You're digging them up and replacing them, or you're relining them or something. You're incurring some kind of like capital expenditure to go and extend their life, right, in some way or another. And the thing about that, so we're doing more of this today than we were in the past, because in the past we were building infrastructure networks from scratch. Today we're going and rebuilding them when they reach the end of life. The thing about that from a sort of investment and revenue and debt perspective is that it's difficult to ask people for more money to continue providing an existing service, right? And so renewal investment doesn't typically have an incremental revenue stream in the way that, say, building a sort of water treatment plant for a new subdivision does, right? In that case, you can charge development contributions, you can charge rates on the new houses, you can charge a targeted rate if that's what it takes to ring fence it. But when it's going and sort of digging up the water pipes in an existing suburb and putting replacements in, you know, the conversation about, okay, you've been paying a given level of rates, now you're going to be paying more rates for the same services is a really hard one, right?
Shouldn't you be a council, given they have to fund depreciation, shouldn't they be using the reserves from those funds to do renewals?
Bingo. This is the kind of pay-go solution to renewals, right? But what we found in other research is that councils haven't been doing renewals at the rate that they would need to keep up with renewals. And not just councils, this is an issue in central government infrastructure as well. So we're seeing it pop up in councils, we're not seeing it pop up in central government because the disclosures are not as good. But what you sort of see there, right, is potentially that we've kicked the can down the roads on some of these renewals that we should have been funding out of depreciation funds. Now it's coming due and we're sort of scrambling around to sort of try to find the money to catch up on the renewals that we weren't doing over the course of, say, a generation.
So where's the money gone?
Well, it's gone to a whole bunch of different places, probably depending upon the case. It would have gone to sort of keep rates down. It would have gone to different types of new capital investment. It might have gone to other OPEX, right? It will vary by case to case, and it's difficult to sort of say based on the financial disclosures we've got exactly what happened there. But in general, you know, some money should have been spent as a kind of current operating expense, but it wasn't, right? And now we're sort of in the situation of working out what to do with that.
Well, that gets into the other aspect that Oh, it's not how you wrote it. It's how I've read it. You described it as a Rorschach test, and I tend to see a lot of similar things in a lot of different kinds of ink blots. And in this one, you described these different periods under the LGFA. So in this early period, councils had access. When it was first set up, it was a cheaper way of accessing credit, and councils weren't particularly leveraged at that point. So it was pretty easy to invest in things that didn't generate revenue. And once you get closer to the debt limits, or at least to levels that you want to keep a buffer at, then you need to be making sure that you're generating revenues out of investment. But you're stuck on that 2.8-to-1 ratio, which makes things pretty hard. When you're at that point, the debt limits served a bit as a fiscal rule, where if it's difficult to force councils to do cost-benefit assessment on things or to present business cases that are other than fantasy, a hard debt limit is a form of constraint, and ratepayers might appreciate that constraint if over the decades of councils raiding maintenance funds for other things and taking on debt to fund stadiums and convention centers and town halls while the water pipes are breaking and so on, if you start putting up proposals to ease the constraint on debt, you might need to accompany it with tighter restrictions on fiscal discipline to take on the role that the debt limits had implicitly been playing.
Well, I think the other component of that mix, right, is good discipline and asset management planning.
Yes.
Right. You know, because this is the thing that sort of knits it together. If we've got a kind of budget constraint, and we're always going to have some form of a budget constraint. This is just math, right? We need to make sure that we're not cutting something that will cost us more in the long term if we don't do it. And asset management has proven to be one of those things. It is never going to be cheaper to rebuild the pipe after it fails.
Yeah. About a year ago, we'd put out a paper looking at the old revenue bond structure that New Zealand used to have. As part of that, I was looking a little bit at U.S. municipal debt markets. There, it seems that the setting debt for, say, a water company that are backed by the revenues from the water company, those come with covenants in them requiring that the water company engage in its maintenance, and penalties that happen and payments that are then made to the bondholders as compensation if the council is, or the council water company is not keeping up with those obligations. Bondholders can impose a kind of discipline on that, right?
Yeah, and I think at the end of the day, that's sort of the main question that we're raising here is, in the Rorschach test, is whether you think this constraint has merit and benefits to it, right? And so on the one hand, you might say, as you're suggesting here, that the constraint leads to some discipline around project selection or repayment or the like. But on the other hand, we heard, you know, in some of the feedback from the report that, you know, if we have a sort of set amount of infrastructure that we want to build, right, the best thing that we can do is make it so it's the cheapest way to do it.
Yep.
And the cheapest way to do it would be to use general obligation debt a la LGFA, right?
Well, it seems like a false economy where there's a whole pile of really strongly positive net present value projects that could be pursued if you had them in a special purpose vehicle that you wouldn't be able to do through general obligation.
And I think the way that we talk about this in the paper is, as Peter suggested, is the way that, you know, setting aside the way how you finance projects, what really matters, what's really important is asset management, but also project prioritization and project selection, right? Because if you're living in a debt-constrained world, if you truly believe we're in a debt-constrained world, then choosing projects that maximize value for money and return economically is really important if you're not willing to, or you face a difficult political economy constraint to raise rates, right? Picking those projects is really, really important.
One thing that I'd really liked in the 1913 legislation to get around, I don't know if it's getting around the political economy constraint or just recognizing that the real world exists. They had a mechanism in there where smaller projects that didn't affect the whole council, that are just a part of the council, you needed to have the assent of the affected ratepayers if you wanted the project to go ahead. So the basic structure was that a community group or council itself would say, here's a project that we think is a good idea. We've put it to a ballot of the properties that are going to be levied over the next 33 and a half years or whatever the period is to finance the works. They say it's great. Can we do it? Well, government checks off that the project's been listed in the Gazette, that the accounting seemed right. Okay, fine. Ratepayers have assented to it. Then council collects the debt that ratepayers have said they want to have. So you get a supermajority saying that they want it. Well, we can hope that councils would, you can set a cost-benefit analysis requirement on it, but the entire time that I've been in New Zealand for 20 years, it's been an exercise in governments trying to do crappy versions of CBA for projects that they want to go ahead for other reasons. If you set on these kinds of projects, that the people who are directly paying for it have to say, yeah, we think this is a good idea, recognizing the cost that we're imposing on ourselves for it, that gives another kind, not really constraint, but it's a way of saying yes, right? Because right now, ratepayers don't have a good way of saying yes, because whenever they say yes, council goes and does other weird stuff.
Well, so, I mean, this is actually something you've got some experience with, Graham, right?
Yeah.
Because this is actually still a part of this sort of local government mechanism in parts of the U.S.
Yeah, I mean, before moving here, I was living in New England, right? And so in New England, the way a lot of infrastructure is built in small towns and even larger towns in that area is, you know, town meeting day. And the way it works is those, you know, their proposals around various infrastructure projects, and the people of the town vote on whether they want to build a or pave a road, you know, that was previously unsealed. And so this exists in the U.S. still, and it's a very unique form of determining whether the residents of a given place are willing to pay for the infrastructure improvements that are being made.
Yeah, I had always seen this as kind of a very American thing, and then Kiwis sometimes get uptight about things that have come from the U.S. But just seeing those structures in the 1913 legislation and some of the projects that flowed from it, right? Like the Nio Town Hall that was built on the assent of the affected ratepayers. They just asked council to put the levy on themselves and they built the town hall and my kids go and do stuff there, right? It's still standing a century later.
Well, that's something that I've had quite a bit of an interest in, right? Because I've got a sort of ancestor who was working in sort of the Avondale Borough Council before it got merged with Auckland Council based on a ratepayer poll. And so he was sort of, you know, running these things and sort of signing off on the works that were being done on the back of it. And I think one of the things you learn when you look back at some of those historical records is the nature of the infrastructure projects that were being done at that point is very, very different than the nature of the infrastructure projects we're doing today. We're talking about really basic upgrades, not sort of paving a road, but having a road in the first place. It's a clay or a gravel road, right? We're you know, having drainage, right? Having a water treatment plant, having sort of electricity distribution and streetlights in the area. If you look back at the sort of records here, it's fascinating sort of what's being built. And I think one of the reasons that that system might have fallen out of favor is that it's really easy to get people across the line with really basic upgrades. And then once you reach a certain level of service, right, willingness to pay for the incremental upgrade, let alone the sort of maintenance and renewal of an existing asset that people have gotten used to, gets harder.
Yeah.
Right. And if you talk to people about what happened at the sort of tail end of New Zealand's local referendum process, they'll tell you that. They'll say, actually, we the last, you know, round of polls we stood up, all of them failed, and so we decided to stop doing it because we'd stop building things, right? Is that, you know, but what that raises the question of is sort of, are there good projects left, you know, once you've done the basic upgrades?
It is a good question. It seemed totally applicable in greenfields. It's pretty easy. Get a referendum of the affected farmers who want to put the paddocks together into a big new subdivision. They all agree to the debt, to the ongoing levy on their properties. I would vote yes for an increased levy on our property that I knew was going only to fixing up the pipes. Like, you can't undo council decisions of the past 40 years, but you can, if given the opportunity, say yes to giving council resource or a council controlled organization resource to deal only with the pipes if you don't trust council with money more generally.
Yeah, I think broadly this, me and Peter have, you know, gone over this hundreds of times, but I think generally the way we sort of landed on this is that, you know, regardless of the system and the tools that you have and how you're using debt finance, you're going to hit a constraint at some point, right?
Sure.
So the constraint in the case of the referendum town meeting day New England type of thing is, are the taxpayers willing to pay for the infrastructure project that you are proposing on a project-by-project basis, right? In the LGFA instance, the constraint is you're at 280%, and so any marginal project from that point on is going to become more expensive,
yep.
Depending upon how what you decide to finance it. And so it really forces you to prioritize the projects that maximize the most value. Let's say you didn't have any sort of LGFA debt constraint. What that constraint would be a la Detroit or Stockton in the US, right? It would be, you'd be borrowing so much and the creditors won't lend you money anymore, yep. right? And so you have to prioritize what's important at that point. So we sort of got to the point that, you know, regardless of whether you think the tools are correct, councils and central government as a whole should think about this as a trade-off, right? And you, at some point, you're gonna need to face a constraint, you know, and that constraint is going to be, you know, whether you think that is a truly binding constraint is a function of what projects you have in front of you.
And I think probably further on that, right? If you're going to get there eventually, one way or the other, prepare for it now.
Yeah. So, you know, we're talking about constraint here, and you know, assume we've done all the good things that have been suggested, you know, making good choices, strong asset management, having, you know, targeted revenue streams, etc. But you're still getting up towards that 280%. What have you looked at in terms of what councils could do to get around that, given they've done all these things, the right things, but they're still up against the constraint? How could they circumvent the current debt limit, assuming that LGFA is still there and it's at 280% or 175%?
Well, I think that maybe the sort of point that I'd kind of make, right, is that if you've kind of optimized up to sort of whatever your limit is, self-imposed, externally imposed, or whatever, and you hit that point and you say, yeah, it's not worth it to us to keep going further, then you should stop.
Yeah, exactly. If you are a council and you're at your LGFA debt limit and you strongly believe that you have a list of projects that will return a significant amount of value to you, that's what we say in the paper. There are options for you to get around that. You can use SPV financing. There's nothing legislatively that keeps you in LGFA. You'd have to refinance all your LGFA debt, but you know,
it'd be a big deal. Yeah,
it would be a big deal. But a lot of this is. You know, there's not overcomeable barriers. They're expensive. And so this is what we're talking about. We're talking about that trade-off and that expense at that constraint point.
But there are things that we can do to reduce that expense at the constraint point. Like, for example, setting legislation so that councils that bail out a CCO face penalties so high that they're worse off for having done so, so that it's credible that they would never do it, so that Standard & Poor can say, well, look, they are forbidden by legislation from doing this, so we are not going to rate that as part of being at the group level.
So are you aware of any councils that are looking at perhaps considering exiting the LGFA or any attempts to increase the debt limits that are there?
No, I don't, not aware of any. I think it's one of those, my sense of this, right, and speaking kind of frankly but not from a position of full knowledge, is that some of what's happening in here at the sort of LGFA participation and the credit rating stuff is actually about councillors signaling of fiscal prudence to their ratepayers, right? And actually, so some of this stuff actually sort of plays out in a kind of political economy sense, you know, around, I think there's a desire out there in the general public to have public entities that aren't behaving sort of wildly financially recklessly. And some of this stuff is a way of signaling that rather than, you know, an actual sort of firm test of that. That would be my kind of view of that.
So no need to make policy changes then?
I wouldn't say no need to make policy changes. I think, but it's worth kind of like really picking over the sort of existing tools and then sort of asking sort of, okay, well, given that you can do this, what's stopping you, right? You know, and if you discover that there's something stopping people from using it that might range from, we didn't know that was an option, to actually there's these massive transaction costs to doing it, and it's a huge pain in the neck. Work out how to deal with those, you know, but you know, start with where we are.
One question I had on the transactions costs, you were talking about the infrastructure funding and financing legislation that Crown Infrastructure Partners are administering for running these special purpose vehicles. There are now two of them in operation, one here in Wellington. I now have a special levy for sludge on my rates bill, and the other one is well far north of here. Tarangar, right? Yeah. you'd noted in there that the minimum feasible size for these things seems to be around $100 million so far. And I've understood that CIP is trying to bring that down. What I'm curious about is how much of that is just a function of how the legislation is set and how CIP works, and how much of it is the way that securities legislation has evolved over the past century. Because if we look back to the 1913 cases, they had very small debt issuances that were backed by special ratings districts, and it all seemed to work.
Yeah, so I think the reason why the IFF, the issuances have been sort of a $100 million scale is because the transaction cost for councils, not just the higher interest rates, but there's a number of different processes that they have to go through in order to establish
you
an
end
SPV.
Up ping-ponging between a bunch of different government agencies and having to go through this sort of sequenced process of getting approval from
I think one thing that is often not necessarily talked about in the SPV world is that in order to maintain the relatively good basis point premium that exists for SPV debt, there's a lot of contractual obligations that exist within SPVs that are placed upon councils to make sure that debt is collected, that debt is paid, that the infrastructure asset that's being built is exactly what the creditors sort of, you know, are seeing and then when they lend money. And so from the council perspective, that setting up that arrangement takes, you know, a fair amount of time. It's about 6 to 9 months. And so the transaction costs of that, I think, for councils, if they're looking at a project that's, say, $15, $20 million, they'll say, that's not worth it. You know, we're not going to spend 6 to 9 months setting up an SPV. So this is why I think CIP has recognized this and is talked about, you know, how can we make this tool such that for smaller projects, we can make it more feasible.
Sweet. We're getting pretty close to time. I'd love any final comments from you, Nick, before turning to a summing up from our lovely guests.
Oh, look, great report. Found it really interesting to read, really good, readable thing. I recommend anyone with an interest in local government funding and financing to give it a good read. Just, I guess, a question in terms of, you know, talk about things like credit rating downgrades and things like that. What's the cost that you see in terms of, say, a council did decide to go off on its own? What would the cost of that be in terms of, say, a rating agency decided to reduce the credit rating that the council had?
So there's some figures in the report for this, and I think that they probably sort of need a little bit of context, probably. The first bit of context is that these are figures that councils themselves have reported in their long-term plans or their annual plans, right? So some councils, but not others, sort of do say kind of, this is what it would look like if we got downgraded. This is what the financial impacts on us might be. The sort of those costs that are reported in those documents tend to be quite small, you know, on the scale of sort of, you know, a few million dollars or sort of less than a percentage of overall operating costs. But probably the caveat to that is it's a little bit unclear whether they're reporting kind of short-run costs, given their sort of hedging strategies and the debt maturity, or long-run costs. And the second thing is that it's also possible that there's going to be some flow-on costs for other things like insurance premiums, which are sometimes tied to credit ratings. So, you know, but it's a kind of indication of sort of what they're reporting the cost to be, and the cost is not that large.
And I think what we wanted to highlight in the report here is that credit ratings are a signal of the cost of debt. They are not an end in and of themselves. And so councils who are, if their goal is to maximize their credit rating, right, that is one goal. But the sort of trade-off of doing that is that you will have to maintain a lower debt burden. And that means, you know, maybe not debt financing your entire infrastructure, you know, portfolio that you want to do. And so what we wanted to sort of bring back to sort of root basics here is that the credit ratings are sort of a signal of the cost of debt. And the cost of debt is your cost of trade-off, right?
Supply curve slope upwards.
Exactly right. So when we hear councils saying, well, we don't want to do this because we don't want a credit rating downgrade, you know, we want to sort of recircle the discussion back to, well, this is them saying that trade-off between a higher borrowing cost, which is, as we note in the report, a certain, you know, a relatively small amount, is too high for us to take on the amount of infrastructure that we currently have in our pipeline.
I guess to me, a really good quote that you had in your report was, just because you can take on more debt doesn't mean that you should.
Bingo. Yeah. That's exactly where we'd want to leave it. You've got to think about what you're taking on the debt for before you sort of look to that as a solution.
Yeah, and I just love the idea of putting this kind of debt into the special purpose vehicle that is backed by its own revenue, meaning then that the debt, when it goes to market, is assessed against the likely feasibility of those revenues. So it's not just council's guess on it and then potentially a ratepayer referendum on it. It also faces a market test on whether the plans seem really plausible. And we've been missing a bit of that recently. This has been a wonderful chat. I've gone over the time that I thought we were going to, but it's been great. I'm sure we'll have you back again. Thanks, everyone. And thank you, listeners. Stay tuned for the next one.
Thank you, Eric.